welcome to Worlds Apart. Most cultures have a long-standing prohibition against gloating at an untimely death, even of a sworn enemy. And deep down, that prohibition serves the very important function of preserving a sense of shared humanity amidst entrenched hatred and polarizing differences. The catastrophic death of the Iranian president and his team in a helicopter crash elicited solemn condolences from much of the world, except for the West. What values are being endorsed by this act of dancing on the grave? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Mohammed Marandi, a political analyst and a professor at the University of Tehran. Professor Marandi, it's great to talk to you again. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, I know that you have worked with President Raisi's family as an advisor, perhaps also as a friend. And I want to begin by expressing my condolences, because I suppose it's not just not only a national loss, but also something that touches you personally.
Yes, I wasn't very close. I met them. I met the president on a number of occasions and his wife on a few occasions as well. The president was a very, very humble person, very polite, very friendly. And also when he would constantly be on the move from one province to another, he would travel to each province at least once a year. And in the province, he would travel from one town to another. And usually he would focus on more deprived areas and on people who've been left behind. So he is particularly popular among the disenfranchised, the working class. And we saw that in the funerals. The Western media, after he had passed away, was bringing on people saying people in Iran are celebrating. And I was on one media outlet, the BBC, and they brought guests before me who were saying this. And then I said, well, let's wait for the funeral and we'll see. And after we saw millions of people on the streets of Tehran and millions of people on the streets of other cities where the funeral procession also went through, suddenly the Western media went completely silent, almost completely silent.
Well, not completely silent, because in the first few days after his death, you know, there was a flurry of publications about his supposedly cruel nature and what effect his demise may have on the country, and specifically whether or not it may lead to the downfall of the Iranian state. I'm being a little bit facetious here, but did you learn anything new about your country and the man from those reports?
You know, we've seen this sort of nonsense coming from Western media for years. Anything that they say about Iran is highly negative. It's been like that since I was a teenager. And so if I see anything that goes against the narrative, I would be surprised. President Raisi, if he was so evil and horrible, we wouldn't have witnessed these extraordinary crowds in Tehran, millions of people. I was at the funeral and I couldn't stay very long because we simply couldn't move. We were stuck. And I was with my family and also my mother, an elderly lady, so we had to leave. But, you know, in the West, they create a particular narrative because it serves a purpose. And they use these so-called Iranians who work for Western media or Western institutions who will say what they want to hear. And those people will know that if they don't say what the American political establishment wants to hear, they'll lose their status, they'll lose their job. So it's something that we've been seeing for decades now. And that's basically the reason why Western analysts and Western politicians and Western leaders always miscalculate, because their assumptions are wrong. And based upon those assumptions, they create policies and they fail. And they wonder why.
Now, you just said that it's been happening for decades, but I still think that it's a relatively modern thing, because in the wars of the past, guns and cannons used to go silent to allow the warring sides to bury their dead. And I think to this day, turning a funeral into a political event is considered a moral sin in most societies, or most traditional societies, because there are things that are above, you know, political immediate, you know, expediency. Why do you think it's lost on Western politicians, like, let's say, U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, who essentially said, when asked about this catastrophe, that it was a good thing?
I think it is another sign of the decline of the Western empire. As the empire collapses, the regimes of the West become more angry and more aggressive and increasingly irrational. We see that in Gaza, in how they are openly supporting an ongoing genocide, and day after day they're trying to justify it. And they, these Europeans and these North Americans who constantly rant about human rights and women's rights, are allowing the Israeli regime to massacre women and girls 24 hours a day. Or when it comes to Ukraine, when everyone knows that the Ukrainian regime is losing the war, they want to sacrifice more Ukrainian young men simply because they want to hurt Russia. So they're willing to destroy Ukraine to hurt Russia. Or they speak about Ukrainian sovereignty, yet on the other hand, they poke China by supporting Taiwan. And they do it more blatantly than before. In the past, they were more subtle. They pretended to be the side that was abiding by international law and human rights. But now the mask is off, and I think this is a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you allow me, I want to ask you one more question about death, because as a war reporter in the past, I think that is actually a major issue, the attitude to death that underwrites foreign policy. And that latest comment by Anthony Blinken about, you know, the catastrophe being essentially a good thing reminded me of his predecessor, Hillary Clinton, who was laughing at the news of Muammar Gaddafi's murder. I mean, and she, by the way, was somebody who visited his own house roughly a year before that. So there's something about Western culture that I cannot quite grasp. But I remember that even in the West, at least when I was studying there, death used to be called the great equalizer, because it humbles people into connecting with their own mortality, the mortality of their loved ones, which is, you know, a source of human empathy at the end of the day. Do you think people like Blinken are even capable of a genuine empathic response, not only for their enemies, but even for their allies?
No, not at all. This is the man who is doing his best to help the Israeli regime continue with its genocide. And you make a good example. Your example of Hillary Clinton was very, very good. She went and said, after people saw the footage of Mr. Gaddafi,
brutally murdered. Brutally murdered.
Exactly. And then she said, "We came, we saw, and he died." And then she laughed in a very sinister way. But now it's, I think, far worse than back then. Hillary Clinton was more crude than most other major politicians at that time. But now it's become almost universal. And as you rightly point out, the language, the behavior has become really extreme in the West. And I think, again, it's because their empire is on the decline. It's rapidly declining. They see it falling, and it just makes them more angry, more hostile, and more full of hatred. And I think the best example is Gaza. The world is watching in shock, and it just doesn't stop. And the West keeps giving the regime more weapons. And every morning when we wake up, we see new horrific images. And when we go to bed at night, right before going, again, we see these images. We can't escape them.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to the catastrophe with the presidential helicopter, you know, tragedies of this scale do happen. They are rare, but they do occur, and they may be used for political or geopolitical purposes. I'm thinking here of the 2010 crash of the Polish plane with President Lech Kaczynski on board, and the allegations and political consequences for Russia that it provoked. Do you expect anything of this sort this time around, this crash being used for, you know, the interest of local or global agents?
Well, first we'll have to see what the investigation reveals. At the moment, the assumption is that it was an accident. There are reasons to believe that it was an accident. It was an old helicopter. He was not using a presidential helicopter. And it is an American helicopter, which, and we know that because of the sanctions, our airlines, our aircraft have very great difficulty in finding spare parts. Also, although when the helicopter took off, the weather suddenly changed and it entered a cloudy area, very cloudy. It was raining and there was heavy fog. In a mountainous place with forests, so the circumstantial evidence for let's say, let me rephrase that. There are questions that need to be answered, and there may be legitimate answers for those questions, but we'll have to wait and see. But the assumption for now is that it was most probably an accident, but we'll have to see.
Now, speculating about consequences, I think it's quite predictable that most Western observers for now focus on whether or not this interim period will provoke street protests in Iran. And I suppose your answer to that would be a resounding no, but simply because that's not the way the Iranian system works. But still, the Iranian political landscape is not void of competition. There are various factions. Do you think this sudden change in leadership may intensify internal jostling for power among various actors?
You know, this is a very good question, a very good question. In the West, on the one hand, and you have these inconsistent narratives. On the one hand, Iran is this dictatorship where the leader makes all the decisions and everyone else just does what he says. But on the other hand, as the president, now that the president's gone, we have this all this competition going on. So these are contradictory. But then again, you have different, as the narrative goes, there's competition for power among these different factions. In the West, that's called democracy. That's called debate. That's called civil society. But somehow the same thing when it comes to a country like Iran, it becomes more sinister. There's a grab, it's a sort of grab for power. So all of these are contradictory, but the Western media will say them all really almost simultaneously, but they don't recognize that none of these things fit together, logically speaking, in a single narrative. Without a doubt, that we will have, the Constitution has the answers for all different cases. In the 1980s, we lost a president due to an assassination by a terrorist group that's based in the West as we speak. And then we had elections in accordance with the Constitution and the president was replaced and we moved on. We will have a new president within weeks. The first vice president right now is assuming the roles of the president in accordance with the Constitution, and Iran will continue.
Okay, Professor Miranda, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Mohammed Marandi, a political analyst and a professor at the University of Tehran. Professor Marandi, as we started discussing before the break, the Iranian political system has space and ample room for competition, but there is also a curating process to ensure that the head of the executive doesn't turn on the system itself, but rather helps steering and developing it in a considerate and careful manner. What's your sense of what the Iranian society is yearning for now? What are the most pressing challenges or the most pressing expectations of the people?
I think it's the economy. Right now, there's a large degree of consensus on Iranian foreign policy. President Raisi's biggest achievement was breaking the isolation that was imposed upon Iran by the United States. He joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and he led us towards better relations with neighboring countries. He also, under his administration, we joined BRICS, and he traveled extensively to Latin America, to Africa, to countries across Asia. So he was quite successful in breaking the siege that the Americans imposed upon the country, and the economy is now growing. For the last 2 years, we had pretty good growth. Over 4% and over 6% this last year. So there have been successes. Of course, life is still difficult for Iranians, and it hasn't yet really reflected itself, this growth, in everyday life. But the country is moving, I think, in the right direction. But the key issue for ordinary Iranians right now is the economy. And so I think the debates that we'll be seeing in the coming weeks and the discussions among the different political camps, they will be focused on the country's economic issues.
Interesting, while you're saying that Iranians, like most people around the world, are most concerned with daily bread and butter issues, almost every Western TV report that I've seen on the President's Raisi's death mentioned him in relation to a stricter enforcement of the hijab and chastity laws. And I think it's clearly the preferred political fetish for the Westerners to try to browbeat Iran. And it's easy for you and me to make a case for cultural hegemony here, but why do you think they choose this particular issue to tie it so much to Iran, where women's representation in social life is among the highest in the Muslim world, and they have many other Muslim allies where, you know, women's dress code is enforced in a much more stricter and punishing way?
I think a lot of it, again, has to do with Orientalism and this otherization and this sense of superiority that the West has. If you recall, when the war in Ukraine began, President Putin was, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, they put up a picture of him, and they were saying that Russia has gone back to its Asian roots or something like that. In other words...
And proudly so, by the way.
Yes, but they try to depict it to their people as if somehow being Asian is barbaric and subhuman and less human. It was quite racist, and it was quite extraordinary that it could be so openly published. You couldn't do that, let's say, in the United States about African Americans anymore, but it can easily be done when it's an Iranian or it's a Russian. So That's an easy way to demonize the other side. And also, I think it has to do a lot with history, because whenever the West in the past tried to present itself as superior, it depicted the other side as inferior for differing, sometimes during different periods of time, for differing opposite reasons. So, for example, the Orient, let's say the Muslims in the 19th century, early 19th century, late 18th century, were often depicted as backward because they were accused of being more homosexual. But then nowadays, the Orient is seen as more backward because they're seen as less accepting of homosexuality. Or in the past, many Africans or Native Americans were depicted as less civilized because the women had covered themselves less than Europeans, and Europeans were more civilized because they were more conservatively dressed. But nowadays, when it comes to this part of the world, Iran, the Iranians are less civilized because the women dress more in a more modest fashion. So a lot of this has to do with this hierarchy of civilizations and culture, where always the West stands at the top, even though often the values through the passage of time reverse.
You've written before that the United States, by pursuing this policy of hegemony, occupation, cultural and economic colonialism, is only making things more difficult for itself, because it no longer brings the desired outcomes, and it alienates not only, the supposed enemies, but also their allies. Do you think there's anything that may persuade Washington to change, if not its course of action, let them stay a hegemon, but at least the style that they do it?
No, unfortunately, I don't think that is going to happen until something catastrophic happens, until some sort of economic collapse takes place, or somehow the United States recognizes that it can no longer dominate the world. The United States, we know, can no longer dominate the world. This is not the United States of the 1950s and 60s and 70s, where it was the global power. The global economy was dominated by the U.S. economy. Relatively speaking, the United States is a much weaker country than before. Many countries are on the rise now. And it's not just China, but there are many others. The BRICS countries, almost all of them are among them. And of course, Iran is one of those important countries that's rapidly rising. But the United States can't adjust to reality. Washington is still in this bubble. They do see what's happening, but still they somehow wish to believe that they will manage things and they will stay at the top. And what is the right thing for the United States to do is to look at the world realistically and try to improve its relations with Iran, with Russia, and others, and to manage this evolving situation. But at the moment, they can't. Their arrogance won't let them do that. But when the time comes, and I'm very confident that will happen, despite a lot of blood probably being spilt until then, when that a catastrophe happens for the U.S. economy, then I think people will force the regime to rethink, and maybe and hopefully we will have a more reasonable leadership in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the blood being spilled, and you referred to the Gaza issue a couple of times throughout this interview. The change in the Iranian executive leadership comes, as you know, at a time of heightened tensions, not only in Gaza, but specifically there, with Israel pushing forward with its indiscriminate offensive. Do you expect any change in sort of the balance of power? Because whether Iran does something or not, it is a powerful gravitating force. So just by being in the region, it affects many ways on the ground. So are you expecting anything to change in terms of the regional dynamics?
I think it's already changed. The West is on the decline, and therefore the Israeli regime is on the decline, because it is completely dependent on the West. On the other hand, the regime has lost in Gaza. Gaza is a dot dot on the map when we look at the globe. Yet the regime has been completely incapable of taking this dot after 8 months. On the other hand, on the border with Lebanon, Hezbollah has defeated it as well. They've been forced to withdraw their whole colonizer, the population that has colonized that region, away from the border. And after 7-8 months, they've been incapable of doing anything about it. In the Red Sea, the United States, in support of the Israeli regime, has failed completely against the Yemeni armed forces and Ansar Allah. And of course, when Iran finally struck back at the regime, I think Iran said that the equation has changed. And after that, the Israeli regime has refrained from attacking Iranians in Syria. So Israel is on the decline. But even more important than its military defeat is the fact that it has been, its credibility and its image across the world, along with the collective West that supported it, has been demolished across the world and even within the West. So the balance of power has tilted away from the West, and definitely the Israeli regime, which is now seen as weak, broken, and vulnerable. And again, the United States and the Europeans do know this. Their leaders know this, but somehow they still live in this fantasy land that where they hope or they believe that somehow their superior civilization and culture will emerge victorious.
Well, the saddest thing of all, Professor Mirandi, is that that fantasy land that they reserve for themselves means a bloodbath for the world, now in Gaza, but also in many other places. We will have to leave it there, but it's been great talking to you as always. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.